and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the corruption scandal in Israel that has ensnared Prime Minister Netanyahu, who Israeli police say there is enough evidence against in two corruption cases to recommend his indictment. Robert Malley, the president and CEO of the International Crisis Group, who was the White House coordinator for the Middle East and North Africa in the Obama administration, joins us to discuss whether Netanyahu will weather the storm of scandal and end up being Israel's longest-serving prime minister. We'll also look into the possibility of an uprising in Gaza as Israel turns the screws, punishing its beleaguered inhabitants who are the victims of an intra-Palestinian power struggle caught between the fanaticism of Hamas and the corruption of Fatah. We will explore the suggestion by Secretary of State Tillerson that the Trump administration has a plan in the works that won't be so lopsided as their lavishly pro-Israel stance so far would suggest, and that the U.S. might demand some concessions from Israel in a deal with the Palestinians in exchange for moving the U.S. embassy to Jerusalem. Then we will examine the resignation of South Africa's President Jacob Zuma, who stepped down today after 8 years in power, the last years of which found him mired in a series of corruption scandals that finally cost him the support of his ruling African National Congress Party. Catherine Newman, Senior Vice President for Academic Affairs of the University of Massachusetts System, and author of After Freedom, The Rise of the Post-Apartheid Generation in Democratic South Africa, joins us to assess what might follow Zuma's spectacular fall from grace. Then finally, with Donald Trump reversing his populist election campaign message of draining the Wall Street swamp and making hedge fund billionaires pay the same tax rate as their secretaries do, we will speak with Sheila Kolhatkar, the author of Black Edge, Inside Information, Dirty Money, and the Quest to Bring Down the Most Wanted Man on Wall Street. Now that Trump is surrounded by former Goldman Sachs executives and is giving away the store to Wall Street, we will follow the tale of insider trading and the downfall of a disgraced hedge fund titan who is now back in business. And joining us now is Robert Malley, who's the president and CEO of the International Crisis Group, which works to prevent conflicts worldwide. He previously was a special assistant to President Clinton for Arab-Israeli affairs, and prior to that was executive assistant to Samuel Berger, the President Clinton's national security advisor and director for democracy, human rights, and humanitarian affairs on the National Security Council. And he served in the Obama administration as White House coordinator for the Middle East and North Africa. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Malley.
Thanks for having me.
And Prime Minister Netanyahu is on his way to becoming Israel's longest-serving prime minister, appears to be in some trouble with the law. There is an expectation he may be able to weather the storm, but there's certainly a lot of demonstrations, etc., against him. But he's in a pretty powerful position, and he's always been underestimated, I guess, and seems to have survived. I think it was you that told me on the first meeting that President Bill Clinton had with Netanyahu, after Netanyahu left the Oval Office, Clinton was so rattled and he turned to his staff and said, "Who is the effing superpower around here?" Is that an apocryphal story?
It's an accurate story that a number of my colleagues and I have recounted over the years. You're right that he has been underestimated, and you're right that nobody should count him out. There's a lot that's accumulating against him, on the other hand, and it's not just the legal cases, and there's more than one. And the Attorney General may well recommend an indictment. But there's also a fatigue, and there's also within his own party some impatience and some eagerness to make way for the next generation, fearing that the corruption scandals that are enveloping him could drag down his party, the Likud, with him. As you say, I think nobody should count him out. He has a number of ways that he's going to try to use to survive yet again.
Well, it may be a surprise to our listeners, but the Likud party that he's the head of is a part of a six-party right-wing coalition, and it's basically in that spectrum. It's pretty much center-right, isn't it, compared to the other parties. So he is a sort of, you know, almost a liberal anchor in a right-wing party. Is that the way to look at it?
That's probably overstating it just slightly. listen, I mean, the Likud's platform today doesn't accept a two-state solution. the majority of the Israeli cabinet today rejects a two-state solution. So, you know, shades of right-wing among all of them, some more than others. I think Benjamin Netanyahu himself is in a odd position because in the past he has said publicly that he accepts a two-state solution. He gave a famous speech in which he laid that out. He has told American officials over the years that there are some compromises that he would accept that go against what his party's platform and has officially endorsed. So I think the real question beyond the legal fate of these cases that are being brought against the prime minister is the fact that we just heard today from Secretary of State Tillerson that the United States, we knew that they were preparing some kind of plan. He says that they are close to being done, that it's going to be a plan that's going to cover all the issues and that it's going to be more fair, certainly, than I think people might expect. You know, let's see what comes up. But I think it's going to be interesting if, in fact, the U.S. puts a plan on the table that has elements that go against the wishes of the Likud party. How does the prime minister position himself? Does he try to say, I'm with the Americans and go to elections on that platform? Or does he oppose a plan if, in fact, it crosses his party's red line?
But I don't think there's been a more pro-Israel administration than the Trump administration, with Jared Kushner, who gave up his bedroom to Netanyahu, who was a regular visitor, family friend, Trump's lawyer, who's quite passionately pro-Israel.
Who has funded settlements.
Right, exactly. I mean, so, and of course, the extraordinary shift in U.S. foreign policy in terms of moving the U.S. embassy to Jerusalem, making the U.S. the only country in the world to take that step, that's an extraordinary step in its own. So how would you rate it, since you've obviously been involved in this for some time?
There is no doubt that the administration so far has done everything to burnish its pro-Israeli credentials, and you've mentioned a number of the pieces of evidence about it, also cutting funding for the U.N. agency that helped Palestinian refugees, and speaking about the Palestinian leader, President Abbas, in ways that are quite negative. So you put all that together, plus the identity of the people who are in charge of the peace process, and a logical conclusion would be not only is it the most pro-Israeli, but it's one that's going to continue to tilt in that direction, both because of the conviction of the people who are leading the charge, but also for domestic political considerations. Weighing against that, and I'm not saying that it's weighing in a very heavy way, but weighing against it is the professed desire by President Trump, which he keeps repeating, that he's going to make the deal of the century, that it's going to be something that both sides are going to have to take seriously. Listen, right until we see it and until we study it, it's going to be very hard for me to believe it. But it is what administration officials say publicly and privately, that their plan is going to surprise the observers by how fair it is. I have my doubts. I'm not sure that their definition of fair is anywhere near mine, let alone the Palestinians or the Arabs or most neutral observers. But, you know, let's wait and see. If he really wants to get a deal, he's not going to be able to continue on this path. He's going to have to say, as he said already, I gave Israel something important with Jerusalem. Now they're going to have to give something important in terms of the concessions they're prepared to make to reach a deal. I wouldn't hold my breath, but according to Secretary Tillerson, we'll soon find out.
And again, I'm speaking with Robert Malley, who's the president and CEO of the International Crisis Group, which works to prevent conflicts worldwide. He was previously a special assistant to President Clinton for Arab-Israeli affairs, and prior to that was executive assistant to Samuel Berger, President Clinton's national security advisor, and was director for democracy, human rights, and humanitarian affairs for the National Security Council. And he served in the Obama White House as the White House coordinator for the Middle East and North Africa. Well, but in terms of the Israeli right and Netanyahu, the leader of the Israeli right, they've never really had an end game, at least one that they want to announce. And now they're really turning the screws on Gaza in conjunction with Sisi of Egypt. Of course, Hamas is a sort of protege of the Muslim Brotherhood, and there's a lot of military activity now in the Sinai, which in fact there's joint Egyptian and Israeli airstrikes. So what do you think the agenda is here? Because you wonder at what point will the Palestinians continue to take punishment there? It seems as though at a certain point, particularly in Gaza, where they're really starving, there may be an explosion.
So I think there's two questions. One, the agenda of the Likud when it comes to the West Bank, there's a divergence, I think, among some, but some of their members want to annex the West Bank and or certainly annex the settlements in the West Bank. And there's a bill that Prime Minister Netanyahu tried to slow down, has slowed down the consideration of, which would have led to annexation. So there's a divergence of view, although it goes from, as I say, right-wing to hard-right. Gaza is a separate issue, and you forgot, I think, two culprits in your list of protagonists who are responsible for the absolute misery of Gaza, and I was there a few years ago, and it is exactly as you describe it. And that's Hamas and Fatah, the two principal Palestinian parties who are making Gaza the victim of their feud for power, their tug of war. And they have not yet reached agreement on how to reconcile, on how to govern Gaza, and therefore Gaza is the victim, as I say, of a collective conspiracy, Israel, Hamas, Fatah, Egypt. Unfortunately, each one of them trying to defend interests that have nothing to do with those of the civilians on the ground who are pawns in this battle. And it is a scandal, but as I say, it's a scandal for which responsibility, unfortunately, is shared by many, not just Israel, but also the Palestinians and also Egypt.
So is there an alternative to these kind of, you've got kind of religious fascists with Hamas, the very word means zeal, and then you've got this corrupt Fatah. Is there a possibility of any political movement that would actually represent the Palestinians emerging?
So I'm not sure I would completely endorse your description of both, but putting that aside, there's no third party. I think it's an illusion to expect a third party to emerge, but there needs to be is pressure from the base, from the ground up, on Hamas and Fatah to put some of their differences aside. They will not unify as one party, but put some of their differences aside for the sake of governance, normal governance in Gaza, and for the sake of agreeing on a political platform which they could then put forward to the international community and to Israel about what their objectives are and how they intend to pursue them. There have been efforts in the past which were trying to say that both should agree on a creation of a Palestinian state by means of nonviolent resistance, but unfortunately they haven't been able to come together on that platform or in terms of how they're going to share power in Gaza or agree on new elections. I mean, there haven't been elections in over a decade, and that is obviously not just corrosive in terms of the ability to regenerate the democratic life among Palestinians, but it means that you now have a national movement that is no longer in tune with or representative of the people on whose behalf it's supposed to be fighting.
Well, that became apparent when the Palestinian papers were leaked, and there was a great sort of resurgence amongst the young Palestinians of basically the evidence of, you know, a stalemate and incompetence from this aging leadership. So that's why I asked that question. But in terms of...
there is going to have to be a rejuvenation of the Palestinian leadership, and there's several elements that are going to have to take place. There's going to have to be some reckoning between Fatah and Hamas. They're going to have to agree on some platform so that they could go to elections and avoid the civil war, which they experienced in the past. There's going to be some transformation in Fatah. I mean, President Abbas is not young. At some point, he will no longer be president, and they're going to have to pass the reins to the next generation. And finally, there's going to have to be a reckoning of the Palestinian national movement as a whole, Hamas, Fatah, and beyond, again, to try to figure out what it is that they're pursuing, on what basis, and with what means. And they face a huge challenge because the international and regional environment today is about as hostile to the Palestinians as it's been in decades.
And that's what makes one wonder. The kind of screws are turning, and it's getting tougher and tougher. And, I mean, if there is some breakthrough here from the U.S. side, which would be a big surprise, as you pointed out, what's your sense of how it's going to play in Israel? Are they really interested anymore in a two-state solution, given that
first of all, you did mention the risk of an explosion in Gaza, and you're absolutely right. The worse the conditions get there, the more likely there's going to be renewed warfare between Hamas and Israel, and I think that's something we really need to watch. There's already been too many wars there, and there could be one more. Your question about the two-state solution, it's a very good one. I mean, I think there's more energy, more support for the two-state solution around the world than there is among the people concerned. I mean, I just came back last month from a trip to Israel and the West Bank. It's very hard to find a Palestinian under the age of 30 who still believes in, cares for, has any faith in a two-state solution. They've moved on. They see what's happening on the ground. they see that the negotiations have led nowhere. They don't trust their own leadership. They don't trust the U.S. as a mediator of the process. So they're on to other things. Some of them given up on politics. Others believe in a one-state solution. Others believe in civil disobedience. So you have a debate, but you don't have a direction, and you certainly don't have sympathy for or embrace of a two-state solution. The same among many in Israel as well. They've moved on because, you know, we've been talking about this since 1993. We were supposed to be over with it in 1999. We're now in 2018, and if anything, the boat has moved much further from a two-state solution in terms of public attitudes, in terms of the realities on the ground, settlement construction, home demolition. So it's very hard today to try to convince people who are not already converted that this is a fight worth fighting for, because they just don't see it happening. And that's why, you know, who knows what will happen with the Trump administration. Anyone who seeks to predict it is on a fool's errand. But we could well be living some of the last gasps of this era of the two-state solution, and then we're going to be in uncharted territory.
Back to Prime Minister Netanyahu's legal problems with the police recommending indicting him on two corruption cases. He's received $280,000 in gifts, largely from a movie producer, Arnon Milchan, and an Australian billionaire. And the other case, of course, involves the main popular daily newspaper that was under competition from the free newspaper from Sheldon Adelson. Apparently, that he was caught on tape. One of his aides actually taped him in a conversation, Netanyahu basically asking the editor of the newspaper to give him favorable coverage and somehow restrain Adelson. So is there a real case there, do you think?
I can't speculate. Obviously, I haven't seen the evidence. I know that it's been mounting, and there's a case where there's smoke, there probably is fire, but I'm not about to pronounce myself on the legalities of what happened. We'll have to let it play out. As I said at the beginning, I think the Prime Minister has different ways he's going to try to use, and those who are following U.S. politics will find it familiar, different ways to try to delegitimize the case against him and live to fight another day.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Robert Malley.
Thanks for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Robert Malley, who's the President and CEO of the International Crisis Group, which works to prevent conflicts worldwide. He was previously a special assistant to President Clinton for Arab-Israeli affairs, and prior to that was executive assistant to Samuel Berger, President Clinton's National Security Advisor and Director for Democracy, Human Rights, and Humanitarian Affairs for the National Security Council. And in the Obama administration, he served as the White House Coordinator for the Middle East and North Africa. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into Donald Trump's reversal of his election campaign of draining the Wall Street swamp and making hedge fund billionaires pay the same tax rate as their secretaries do.